Thank you, Patrick. We've heard, I think, sort of the two areas, the macro effects, the way in which mankind is destroying the planet in the large, and then Bruce, of course, talked about how mankind is destroying the planet in the small. The pesticides are killing us, and if we're not doing that, we're all going to burn to death. And we've heard a lot about why this is occurring, why there's this strong tendency when science becomes politicized to never let theories that are politically useful be shot down by adverse data. Steve Schneider, who Patrick mentioned and I believe Fred mentioned last night, is one of the environmental enthusiasts in this area, global warming enthusiasts. I was on a program once with him, and I pointed out that, Steve, you're the person who said it once was cooling, and now you're saying it's warming. And he looked at me with those big doe eyes he has and said, Fred, that's the trouble with scientists like myself and advocates like you. When the data suggested the world was getting cooler, I was saying that the world was getting cooler. The data has come in and it's changed the perception, and now I think the data suggests it's getting warming, and I'm saying that. I go where the science takes me. I said, Steve, it's a good theory, but when the world was getting cooler, you wanted massive federal and international intervention in the economy to save the world. And now that you believe the world's getting warmer, you want massive federal and international intervention to save us from ourselves. It seems to me that no matter what the theory is, your answer is always more government. And I think we understand that's what's really playing here, and it operates itself both in the ideological sphere and it operates in the reward structure. There's a lot of money in bad science, and we're about to hear how it comes about. Our next speaker is Steve Malloy. Steve brings a little bit of different flavor to all this. Steve is going to talk to you about how science in a political world deteriorates into junk science. Many of you who have been surfing the web will hopefully have turned on to www.junkscience.com and seen a way in which the insanity of current environmental policy can be made a humorous issue. Steve Malloy has done a lot to make us aware that it's not only dumb and evil, it's also funny. And Steve can tell us a little bit about that now. Steve. Steve heads the task. Steve heads TASS, which is one of the groups that is doing a lot to try to bring about sound science discussions in Washington.
Well, I'd like to thank the Philadelphia Society for inviting me to speak here today. It's a great honor to be part of such a distinguished panel. The two scientists on my right and left are people that I really admire, and I appreciate being here. What I'm going to talk about is sort of the process of how science gets corrupted. We're going to start talking about how science was corrupted, say, up till the Clinton administration took over, and the term I'm going to use there is science policy. Since the Clinton administration has been in office, we switched from science policy to just straight-out junk science. And we'll try to... I'll walk you through both of them so you can understand. And Stan also asked me at the end of my talk to just give a few words on this on the big tobacco debate going on right now. I said we're going to start with science policy. Now, by the term science policy, I don't mean something like whether the budget of the National Institutes of Health should be increased or whether we should aim at putting a man on Mars. What I mean by science policy is something much further removed from the front pages, but with far more relevance to public policy. Science policy is a term of art used to describe policy choices made to bridge gaps and uncertainties in the science relevant to assessing risks to human health and the environment. That process is called risk assessment. Let me give you an example. If you remember several years ago, 60 Minutes ran a story on the pesticide Alar. Alar is actually not a pesticide, it's a plant growth regulator that improves apple texture, appearance, crispness, and storage characteristics. The 60 Minutes report claimed that Alar residue in apples caused cancer shortly thereafter the Washington apple industry went up in smoke. But was there any science that indicated that Alar caused cancer in humans who consumed apples? Well, there certainly weren't any studies of increased cancer rates among humans who ate Alar-containing apples. Instead, there were only some laboratory animal experiments that indicated that rats that ate large quantities of Alar on a daily basis for 2 years had higher rates of cancer as compared with rats who had no Alar. So the question becomes, do these laboratory animal experiments constitute persuasive scientific evidence that LR causes cancer in humans? Well, I say no. First, laboratory rats aren't people, although the converse isn't always true. While there may be biological similarities between rats and people, and rats may be useful models for answering some questions relevant to human health, the fact is that there are also substantial differences between rats and people. And these differences prevent us from concluding that just because laboratory rats react one way to a chemical, humans will react the same way. Now, if nothing else, the rats used in laboratory experiments or toxicology experiments are especially bred to be susceptible to getting cancer. In a sense, they're cancer time bombs. And the same cannot be said for the average human. Now, in the LR experiments, the laboratory rats were fed very high doses. For a human to eat an equivalent amount of LR, he or she would have to consume 28,000 pounds of apple daily for 10 years. That would be quite a feat. So I doubt that anyone can reasonably view the laboratory animal experiences as convincing scientific evidence that LR causes cancer in humans. Yet, EPA deemed LR to be a human carcinogen, and the chemicals no longer used in apples. Now, how did EPA reach the conclusion that LR caused cancer in humans? EPA simply assumed that rats and humans are the same biologically. And EPA also assumed that if high levels of LR cause cancer, then any level of LR will cause cancer. So although the scientific evidence is not convincing in the least, because of EPA's assumptions, for regulatory purposes, LR is a carcinogen. Now, these assumptions are what I referred to earlier as science policy. They aren't science. They are simply policy decisions used to bridge gaps and uncertainties in scientific knowledge. But they're even more than policy decisions, which sounds sort of benign. These assumptions are, in fact, value judgments, the value judgment being something known as the precautionary principle. And I think Fred has actually given it that moniker. The precautionary principle is better safe than sorry. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I'd like to give you some more examples of science policy frequently used by EPA. these science policy decisions are also known as default assumptions. That's sort of a term of art for them. Several years ago, EPA was considering whether it could label fiberglass fibers as causing cancer. But there was a problem. The scientific studies of workers exposed to fiberglass fibers didn't show higher rates of cancer. Scientific studies of laboratory rats made to breathe air contaminated with fiberglass fibers also didn't show higher rates of cancer, but this really wasn't a fair test because the rats couldn't even physically inhale the fibers. So because the rats couldn't inhale the fibers, a scientist came up with the idea that, hey, we'll just inject the fibers into the lungs of the rat. And lo and behold, those rats had higher rates of cancer. Of course, I know you're wondering, what's the relevance to humans? What's the relevance to humans of a study where rats are injected with fiberglass fibers right in their lungs? Well, as a matter of science, there probably is not much relevance. But as a matter of EPA science policy, if a substance can be shown to cause cancer in any one way, shape, or form, then EPA assumes that the substance can cause cancer in any other way, shape, or form. Now, another major science policy decision is the utter rejection of exculpatory information. Now, in the United States, if you're arrested for a crime or sued for a civil wrong, you're entitled to present a defense. I say usually because this is no longer true in my home state of the People's Republic of Maryland, which just passed a law stripping the tobacco industry of the right to defend itself against the state in litigation over recovered health care costs. We'll talk about this a little later. Anyway, the right to present exculpatory evidence on one's behalf does not exist in the world of EPA risk assessment. Exculpatory evidence may be, for example, that a study does not show that a chemical increases cancer rates. So let's say, for example, that you have two scientific studies on a particular chemical. One shows that the chemical causes cancer, the other fails to show that it does. And for the sake of our example, let's just say that both studies are of equal quality and credibility. Now, scientists looking at both studies would throw their hands up and say, well, we need more evidence to really make a decision. But not EPA. EPA science policy says that the study that reports no association between the chemical and cancer does not exist. EPA simply pretends the study was never done. So all you're left with is the study that shows that there is an association between the chemical and cancer. In the world of EPA, you can never prove that a chemical is safe. You can only prove that it causes harm. Now, we've I've discussed four science policy decisions or types of decisions. There are many more. And what's worse is that in any given EPA risk assessment, these assumptions get chained together. So you get results that are wildly conservative, and not in a good way. They wildly exaggerate risk. And several years ago, I did a report examining the use of risk assessment in EPA Superfund program. That's the federal program for cleaning up hazardous waste sites. I found that when EPA evaluated the human health risks from Superfund sites, EPA calculated risks that are at least hundreds and thousands of times overestimated. For example, in addition to essentially assuming that various chemicals cause cancer, EPA also assumes that families who will live on hazardous waste sites drink a half gallon a day of the most contaminated groundwater, and they assume that small children will eat a teaspoon of the most contaminated soil every day for years. At one Superfund site, EPA calculated the risk of lung cancer from radon exposure to be 400 times the risk of lung cancer for a heavy smoker. According to EPA estimates, 90% of the men living at the site and 75% of the women would die of cancer. Now, with risks like that, surely the name of the Superfund site would be as etched in our minds as, say, Love Canal or Times Beach. But the reality is that none of you have probably ever heard of the Montclair, New Jersey Superfund site, and there's a very good reason for that. The risks that EPA estimated have never materialized, despite people having lived there for decades, certainly long enough to experience to get the diseases EPA claimed. In the end, virtually the entire EPA Superfund program exists because EPA assumes that hazardous waste sites are so dangerous, something which has never been borne out in studies of surrounding populations. And therein lies the reason for science policy. Without it, EPA would have little to do. There would be nothing to scare us about or protect us from. Now, there's no question that since EPA's inception in 1970, the environment is cleaner. Now, some would say that our environment is cleaner in spite of EPA, not because of it. You see, even when our environment was in its most polluted state, whether you're talking air pollution, water pollution, hazardous waste sites, or the indiscriminate use of agricultural chemicals, pollution and chemical use were not public health problems. A student learning today about the environment might have the impression that before the Clean Air Act in 1970, millions were being choked by air pollution. Of course, the irony is that after 25 years of oppressive EPA regulation, which may or may not be associated with decreasing air pollution levels, asthma rates are inexplicably soaring today. The same student might have the impression that Love Canal was a sentinel event leading to the passage of the glorious Superfund law, without which we'd all be dead from cancer and our children would all be saddled with birth defects. But if you read the records of the couple thousand Superfund sites across the country, in none of those records will you find a single documented occurrence of an adverse health effect traced to a Superfund site. As a matter of fact, I would say that more people have been killed or injured cleaning up Superfund sites than from chemical releases. The bottom line is that, in reality, the environment, at least in the United States, has little, if anything, to do with our health. And certainly the environment is not a public health problem, as that term is traditionally interpreted. So here's where science policy and the precautionary principle enter the fray. Remember, the precautionary principle is better safe than sorry. That's also the EPA motto. Every gap and uncertainty in environmental science is filled with the science policy of better safe than sorry. Think about every assumption we discussed. Each one is a total embrace of a worst-case scenario. Sure, laboratory rats aren't people, but let's just assume they are, and then we'll be playing it safe. Now, one key problem is that the questions about our environment we are being forced to answer now are increasingly difficult to answer with science, if not virtually impossible. The Clean Air Act originally focused on particulate matter called PM10. It's particulate matter of about 10 microns in size with the width of human hair. We still don't really understand the health effects of PM10. But now it's a moot point because EPA has driven the policy process so that we're now looking at regulating PM2.5, particulate matter 4 times smaller than PM10. Should we regulate PM2.5? Who knows if we should be regulating PM10? The gaps in scientific knowledge are immense. And EPA steps right in to fill them with policy. We've already assumed that PM10 is harmful, so PM2.5 must be worse. Now, this little bit of science policy has accounted for what can only be described as the most expensive environmental regulation of all time, last year's new air quality standards, which has been estimated to cost the economy in excess of $100 billion annually. And this regulation was all created out of thin air, no science. Now, the worst part of all this is that there's virtually no opportunity to change this through the existing regime. You can do all the scientific research you want in order to resolve any gap or uncertainty in scientific knowledge in hopes of eliminating a particular science policy decision. The sad truth is that there is no established or reliable process for getting rid of science policy. Science policy only disappears at the whim of EPA. And EPA will dispense with science policy, but only when it helps the agency. During the 1970s and early 1980s, EPA pushed hard to replace leaded gasoline with unleaded gasoline. During the 1980s, laboratory animal experiments appeared indicating that unleaded gasoline caused cancer. Applying standard science policy, this meant that unleaded gasoline also caused cancer in humans. But what would the public say about EPA, given that EPA has been foisting gasoline that caused cancer? EPA's own credibility was at stake. This set EPA into a panicky search for better science. And by the early 1990s, EPA had decided that the laboratory rats used in the unleaded gasoline studies were in fact biologically different from humans. So EPA decreed that the animal studies had no relevance to humans, and just like that, unleaded gasoline was off the hook. Something similar happened with fluoridated drinking water. The Public Health Service has been pushing fluoridated drinking water for the last 50 years or so. In the early 1990s, a controversy came to a head about whether fluoridated drinking water was causing cancer. Some studies of humans reported that it did, others did not. Now remember earlier, I said that studies that show something is not a health problem are generally ignored, except in this case. To help save its reputation, the Public Health Service decided to drop standard science policy and rely on studies that reported no health effects from fluoridated drinking water. Now, while EPA probably did make the right decision in the case of unleaded gasoline, and Public Health Service made the right decision in the case of fluoridated drinking water, I think one would be hard-pressed to conclude that these decisions were made for the right reasons. These decisions were made for political, not scientific or public health reasons. to be fair to EPA, they are doing something to minimize and even eliminate the use of science policy. Although I think I'd rather have the science policy. At least you knew what the gaps and uncertainties in science were. What EPA is doing now is far more insidious than science policy ever was. EPA has learned that it can buy science, and more precisely, it can buy junk science. EPA, to create junk science, EPA can give a grant or a contract to a favored or reliable scientist who can then resolve a scientific controversy for EPA. Earlier, I mentioned last year's expensive new air quality regulations. As it turns out, the new standards were largely justified on the back of a single study paid for by EPA, published in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, which is a journal published by the American Lung Association, who EPA also paid. EPA has paid the American Lung Association about $4 million since 1990. American Lung Association used that money to sue EPA to issue new standards. So it's a real it's a real vicious circle there with EPA. Thank you, Fred. So here we have a study published in to the layman, a credible journal, filling the gap in knowledge over whether PM2.5 is a health problem. Now remember, there's no science that shows PM10 is a health problem, let alone PM2.5. Now, as Michael Goff and Cato Institute and I described in January 1997 Wall Street Journal op-ed, the study is classic junk science. It was a poorly conducted study with exceedingly weak results that were way overinterpreted. Yet it was good enough for EPA to declare that the science shows that currently unregulated air pollution kills. Now, unfortunately, the study could not be effectively criticized during the public comment period. The data underlying the study was never made available for independent peer review. The researchers refused to make the data available, and EPA refused to force the researchers to give up the data for independent peer review. This secret science is all the more shocking because the study was paid for by tax dollars. Imagine that we're paying for this study and then aren't permitted to see the data, but are then forced to pay for the most expensive environmental regulation ever. So this is the threat we face today. No longer are gaps and uncertainties in science filled by science policy. They are filled with what can only be called junk science. Now, many of you are probably wondering, what exactly is junk science? Well, junk science is kind of hard to define. As in 1964, the Supreme Court said about obscenity, we can't define it, but we know it when we see it. Junk science is sort of the same way. If I had to put it in a sentence, I'd say that junk science is the exaggeration or inappropriate interpretation of scientific results by lawsuit-happy trial lawyers, the food police, environmental chicken littles, power-hungry regulators, ambitious politicians, and unethical to dishonest scientists to fuel specious lawsuits, wacky social and political agendas, and the quest for personal fame and fortune. Now, since I'm running out of time, I would like to say a few words about the ongoing tobacco controversy. Now, there is no question that if your goal in life is to live as long as you can, that smoking is not going to help you get there. Smoking has very definite and known risks to it. There's no question about that. Smoking is not a healthy thing to do. That said, not everything that they say about smoking and tobacco is true. Just this week in the newspapers, we found out that the bad thing about marijuana use is that it leads to smoking. If you open your newspaper, you'll see ads from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids saying that 1,000 kids die every day from smoking. Now, Bruce Ames just said that a heavy smoker will take 8 years off his life. Well, for white women, life expectancy is approaching 80 years of age. That means that a woman born today can expect to live to be 80 on average. Half will live beyond that, half will die before that. So if you take 8 years off 80, that's 72. Only an advocacy group could think that a 72-year-old is a kid. You also hear the number 400,000 smokers die every year. Well, there's no question that a lot of people die every year, and it has something to do with smoking. Whether the number is 400,000 or 300,000 or 500,000, who knows? The scientific fact is that they can't calculate any number like that. Mortality is a very complex event. Smokers, not only do they have the habit of smoking, but they also have some other lifestyle characteristics which are associated with higher rates of mortality. They have lousy diets. You hear Bruce say diet is a very important component to health. They don't exercise. They tend to drink more. They have stressful lives. All these things contribute to mortality. How people think they can calculate a 400,000 number is ridiculous. Now, even though they can't calculate it scientifically, they do. And I referred earlier to what the state of Maryland's new law this was passed 2 weeks ago. The state of Maryland says that when it sues tobacco companies to recover health care costs, it no longer has to show that an individual's illness or death or the costs incurred for that individual were caused by smoking. All they have to walk into court with is this 400,000 number, or you know whatever the number is for Maryland, and that that statistical artifact is good enough for convicting the tobacco industry. Now, however you feel about the tobacco industry, it's wrong to torture science and statistics and to change the law to do so. So. Don't believe everything you hear about tobacco. It's not a healthy thing, but not everything they say about it is true. With that, I'll end.